or I don't know how I found out later, the regent, or to try to get Hungary out of the war, either to remain neutral or by joining the Allies. And the Nazis got wind of this, and that's why they occupied Hungary, because nobody could, they afford that. By then, by 1944, the things weren't going too well for the Nazis, and so they occupied Hungary on the 15th of March 1944, and shows you that, for instance, in the Warsaw Ghetto, if you think about it, it took years for people to be sent to Auschwitz or to other of the camps. But in Hungary, from 15th of March, the Germans came in, and by the 17th or 18th of June, I was in Auschwitz. So 3 months and 3 days, you know, the speed of it.
So were you moved from your own house into somebody else's house in Hungary?
We had our own house, of course.
Yeah.
It got bombed, so it's no longer there.
Once the Nazis took over Hungary, what happened to your family and to yourself?
As I said, the speed at which things were going. 15th of March they came in, the 16th of March you already had to wear the yellow star. And then you had to move to what was called the ghetto. It was the street the gypsies lived in. And so presumably in other cases the gypsies moved in, but it so happened that a flat at the very end of the street, which was almost out of the street, so it was dicey whether they would allow us to take it, belonged to my granny's chiropodist. So she moved in to our house and we moved into one room.
Was that you and your mother and your grandmother?
My parents, my sister, mm-hmm. and my grandmother. My sister is over there, my younger sister.
Five of you in one room?
Yeah.
And then very quickly you were all sent to
Auschwitz? And then we were there perhaps a month, and then we had to move to a disused brick factory beside the railway station. I don't know why they had built these, presumably for transportation beside the railway station, but it was apparently standard practice that the Nazis, and therefore then the Hungarians, put people in there. And there was, of course, no water, and you could take, can't remember, 50 kilograms or whatever, with you. But of course you had to have a sleeping bag because you were lying on the ground and there was no nurse. We were lucky in a way that my father was in charge of the carriage we were in, that nobody went mad there. Some people went mad in the course of the journey and others committed suicide. So it was one of the worst part of it, because you were still with your family. Mm-hmm. And especially to see your granny in those conditions was really heartbreaking. Then when, I never heard of Auschwitz. Auschwitz is the German name given to it. Auschwitz was the Polish name. When you got off the train, the men had to go one way straight away, and the women and children had to line up, and Dr. Mengele, the angel of death, as he was nicknamed, was waiting at the head of the row. I don't know if he attended every selection, but when the Hungarian trains came in, there were two or three transports every day, and the rate of survival in those conditions, and not going straight to the gas chamber, was
extremely low.
Going forward towards Mengele, I was on the left-hand side, and my sister, who was then, I think, about 11, was beside me, and then my mother and her sister, who was, I think, something like 8 years younger or something than my mother, supporting on either side of my grandmother, and then my younger cousin was the same age as my sister. at the end. As we were coming up, if my sister had been on my mother's other side, then she would have come with me. But my sister was too young, and Mengele was by then, he was either tired of it all or wanted to hurry. So he didn't say you and you and you. It was, I was handy there on the left. I went one way, and of course I didn't know then, but my mother and my sister and 90%, I think, of all the others went straight to the gas chambers.
You were young enough to work?
Yes, I suppose so. And well, as they lined us up, and those who Mengele chose for life, I suppose, we went along past barbed wire and people shaving head, jumping up and doing some kind of a weird dance and shouting in Hungarian, I suppose, but it was incomprehensible. And so I said, by then I'd found two of my friends, I said, this must be the lunatic asylum. And about half an hour later, we also had our heads shaved, and they had taken our clothes away, and they sent us to what was showers, and the gas chambers also said showers on them, and they were told that they were going to showers, except that their gas came from the taps, and with us it was water. Then, before we left Auschwitz, they put us into a building, or a large room, I suppose. Well, it had to be quite large to contain 500 of us, called gas chamber. And we went in there and we had to sit there. There were low sort of seating all in a circle. And we were by that time in such a confused state of mind that we were making corny jokes about wonder when they turned the taps on and so on. And however, and then I can't remember who, but perhaps it was an SS sergeant or somebody, said that we were going into Western Germany on a long train journey, but if the Red Cross or anybody comes and they ask us about our parents or anything, if anybody says anything that they shouldn't say, they'll be shot. However, we didn't get the Red Cross to us.
And this was after spending some time in Auschwitz?
3 months.
You were 3 months there. Well, you didn't work during that period?
No. And then the worst thing was that there was no water. I was in Birkenau, actually, which was for the women, and there was no water. And there was a kind of ditch filled with water by the barbed wire, and you can manage without drink, you know, you can get other drinks, you know. The less there is, the more you want it. So some people went and drank from it, and they ended up with typhus.
What happened after you arrived and were shaved?
They shaved us all. Then, well, then they sent us to this gas chamber, kind of.
And you washed there?
No showers in that one.
What was a typical day
in
like
Auschwitz?
In Auschwitz, yes.
They would go round and count you all the time. That would have taken a long time, standing while they just kept counting you.
Oh, absolutely.
You were standing there for the whole day. Did people not collapse from exhaustion? Did not fall down?
You had no names. I was 152.
Go back to where you were before. You were told that you were being sent to Western Germany. What happened then?
I eventually got on a train and arrived in Western Germany, in Lippstadt. And we were assigned to work there in an iron and metal works. I don't know if it was a week or 2 weeks. Well, a very short time after we arrived, I was called, or I was carrying something in the factory, and it was a stone floor, and my glasses fell off and broke. So our own camp commandant was a girlhood friend of my mother's. So I went to see her and I said, well, this is what happened. She said, oh, well, you can't go to the factory then. I said, but why not? I said, I'm not blind. And it's a very difficult machine work. That's all I have to do, raise my arm up and down. And she said, oh, but you are as blind as a bat, and you cannot go back. So I didn't. And I went along into the German kitchen every day.
Do you think she did that to help you out of the ammunitions?
Did she do it on purpose to make your life easier?
Who?
The camp commandant. Did she do that to make your life easier? Was it an easier life in the kitchen?
I don't know for what reason, or they just need somebody. It sounds absolutely disgusting now, but whatever the Germans left on their plates, I ate it. You know, we were hungry. I managed to get hold of a pair of overalls and tied them at the ankle. And when I was sent to the stores for, I don't know, anything, I'd pinch a couple of onions and carrots and things and let them go right down to my ankles, so that when I had to go back to the camp and they sort of felt me around, they didn't go right down to the ankles. So
that was brave of you.
Oh, I know. I know.
And
but
did you then share that with your friends?
Yes, of course. Yeah. Well, I took them to them. And there came a jaundice outbreak, and I had to go into Lippstadt every day with an SS sergeant to collect a big container of some special food that was for those who had the jaundice. The only trouble was that while they had the jaundice, they couldn't eat. And by the time they were better, they didn't get their special food. So it was a very difficult situation. It was impossible to describe the feeling I had when I went into Lippstadt and I saw buses and trams and women pushing prams. You know, that life had gone on when we were asleep.
It's bizarre, isn't it? It's like two parallel lives, one normal life totally ignoring another section of the population.
Yes, so I had to work in the German kitchen and collected this food for the journalists. And by this time, there was quite a number of them. I also had to sweep the grounds, grab one of the SS officers' room and also a sergeant's room. And he was very kind. He left an apple on the table and pointed to it and he said, eat it. And I was afraid that, you know, if I touched it, then I would be bang, bang. But I ate it and nothing happened. So, you know, they weren't all horrible. Most of them were, you know. I mean, I feel no pity for any of the Nazis. When I was leaning in through the window into the jaundice room, talking, and suddenly I felt myself sailing through the air because one of the Germans came up behind me and kicked me in the backside. Then, just in time for me to catch jaundice, the camp commandant decided that that was too much. There were too many, and he lined us all up. And when it came to me, he pulled my lower eyelid down, and he said, day shift. So I was back in the factory, but day shift only.
Were you and your friends not sabotaging the equipment that you're preparing?
Did you try and damage the things that you were making for the Nazis? I remember you said you did.
This was a bit later. First I was with the Italians, the monster of a machine, I can't remember now what it was. First of all, they got their meal in the factory and they took up, instead of two meals, they took up three. And we had a sort of a dark red bowl, and people wrote in yellow paint their number on it, and mine was 152. The Italians collected one more than they needed, collected three instead of two, and they put it into a bowl, and the Germans sooner or later discovered it, and I was terribly lucky that the bowl with the number on it, one had the food in it and the other covered it. was the one that had my number on it, because he threw that away and took the food away, so he didn't know which was. So I was lucky that way.
I believe you were finally forced onto a death mat. The war drew to a close as the Germans eventually lost the war or were losing the war. Did you remain in Lippstadt or did you have to leave?
In January 45, about 70 people who were ill with various things were sent away by train to, they said, Bergen-Belsen. Didn't mean a thing. And now, at the end of March, or well, middle of March, I suppose, a rat poisoning incident and falling asleep when...
Tell Angela about the rat poison.
I told you that gun commandant was a girlhood friend of my mother's, so she expected me to go and see her at least once a week. But by this time, the air raids were absolutely non-stop, practically. So I was on permanent day shift, but my friends were 1 week day shift, 1 week night shift. And when they were on night shift, then they obviously slept during the day. When the air raids came, the Germans were desperate to get to the shelter. Even the Polish guest workers and everybody went to the shelter except the Jews. We had to go back to our campus right beside the factory. We had to go back there. They put on the high voltage and ran to the shelter, and that was that. We knew that we were going to be evacuated. So I went to see René, that was the name of the camp commandant, and yet another raid, all the lights out. And as I came out, I said, I must get back to her room. And coming out of her room, which led on to the biggest room where the bread was distributed, and in the dark I bumped into this cupboard, and as I tried to find my way, the door opened and there was this big curtain, and it was open, and I put my hand inside and I sort of felt like small, the size of peas perhaps, and I tasted one. Stupid of me, when I could have fell down dead on the spot, but you didn't think of these things. So I tasted it, and immediately I felt raging thirst, so I didn't take any more, but I took it with me, and I sort of made my way back somehow slowly to my room, and I said, anybody hungry? Ask a stupid question. I said, okay, then hold out your hand. And they said, well, what is it? And I said, I don't know, it's some kind of cereal I found in the cupboard outside Renee's room. So in the dark, complete darkness, people held out their hand, and I poured until it was finished. Well, I had very little because, as I say, it made me very thirsty, and another trip down to the end of the corridor where the water was, I just didn't fancy. So when the light came on, we looked at the box and it said rat poison. Heavens, we didn't have a doctor, but there was a nurse in charge. So we went along, about 7 or 8 of us, whom I treated so kindly. And the nurse said, well, you only just eaten it, so it will be still in your stomach and digested. So make yourself sick, bring it up, and you'll be okay. So she said, yes, okay. And everybody, Julie, brought back what they had eaten, except 2 people. That was a girl called Bianca, or Blanche, and me. So we tried, we pushed spoons down our throat, but nothing doing. Then, because we were being evacuated and supposed to be walking to Belsen, we sort of forgot about it. And we marched only by night, and during the day they put us into some kind of barn. And the second, I think it was the third day, that were liberated by the Americans. And this girl, Blanche, said to me then, the Italians, I said, they'd given me a pouch with the lipstick and so on. Well, and I took out the comb and broke it in two, so each barrack had a half a comb, because you only had this much hair, but it was all the more precious. I say we got liberated, and then Blanche said, listen, give me your comb, because I haven't had a comb in my hair for I don't know how long. So I gave her the comb and started brushing, and it was absolutely horrifying.
Did her hair fall out with the rat poison?
It came out, she became completely bald, but not the way we were bald when the Germans shaved us. Mm-hmm. She was a very dark girl. I mean, you could tell from when she had the hair completely black, her eyebrows still black, but she was getting absolutely hysterical because
the hair was coming out in a comb.
So somebody said there was a cottage hospital a few miles away. So we got hold of a couple of bicycles, because first of all, Bianca's German wasn't very good. Mm-hmm. And also I was the supplier of the evil stuff. So I felt
a responsibility.
So we went along, we cycled along, and they took her and they massaged her head, they gave her cream, and I interpreted. And so after, I don't know, perhaps half an hour or an hour, they came to me, and with a big smile on their face, one of the doctors said, now, I can't tell you what's going to happen, because I don't know if the roots have been destroyed or not. The roots have been destroyed, and she's not going to get
her hair
back. But if they haven't, then she might, but it's going to be a long job. And so it was. It's about 6 months for her to start growing again.
Going back to Auschwitz, you went to a few selections before Mengele when you were at Auschwitz, didn't you?
Not a few, perhaps two or three, and then...
Was there not one when you said that you thought you heard your mother's voice when you'd lost your glasses?
I don't know if this happened, probably not every time. But at that particular selection, if you wore glasses, you weren't chosen. You were left behind in Auschwitz. So we were in a row of five, and then the first one got chosen to go. You know, was taken out of the row and made to stand against the barrack. And then the second one was my friend Eva, she's still in Hungary. Then it was Yoli. And then it was me and a cousin, not of mine, but a cousin of Shoshi's, or an aunt of Shoshi's, who was behind us. She was, well, my mother's age, I suppose. And we were all chosen. Yoli was behind me. It was very, very small and sort of thin. And then the three of us had been chosen. And it came to the row where Yoli was. Behind Mengele, we all sort of stuck out our chest. But before that, when it came to my row, I mean, I didn't know that my mother was dead. She had been put to the gas chamber half an hour after we arrived. But I swear to this day, I heard my mother's voice saying, off with those glasses. And I took them off and sort of pushed them with my feet under my... because we had to stand in my birthday suit, and...
That saved your life?
Yeah.
The glasses, you would be selected for the gas chamber?
I don't know for sure.
Well, that's what
and,
you heard.
And I think Mengele's changed his mind. He was very interested in experiments with twins.
What did you say you did with your food? Cutting it up? How did you manage? Did they give you a square of bread a day in Auschwitz?
Well, we got one slice of bread. Day, that was in the evening, and it was one of those things. I was obsessed by the idea of they want to make animals of us, well, I'll not let them. So that's why, for instance, one day I'd think in Hungarian, next day I'd think in German. The next day I think in French. Mm. I had a number of languages. I had practically no Hebrew, but I had some verbs.
So what did you do with your bread to prove you were human?
So what I did was, the way I think in these languages, I also decided that one day I used to get the bread and wolf it down.
Most people wolfed it down immediately.
No, not everybody, somebody you know.
Judith Rosenberg.
How do you know?
You told me before.
What did Judith do?
She cut them up into dainty little squares. So she had her breakfast, she had her three-course lunch, and she had her three-course dinner.
Did you not cut yours into pieces as well? You didn't wolf yours down right away, did you? Did you not break it into pieces? Not as small as Judas, but did you not keep some for later?
I don't know. The thing is, you were risking of it getting stolen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I
thought you normally would break yours up into pieces and have some at one time, some a bit later. You told me that.
You were liberated by the Americans, and somehow you ended up here in Scotland. How is it you ended up in Scotland?
It was because I had a great uncle and a great aunt in Scotland. I don't know if you know Mrs. Kiwi.
So who was your great aunt and uncle?
Dr. and Mrs. Banyai. They lived in Ayr at the time. And I discovered, meanwhile, that I had my cousin to whom I gave my papers. I was chairman or vice chairman of Hanwar Hatsioni.
In Hungary?
Yes, in Hungary. So they sent them some false papers for me, and for a number of reasons I didn't want to go.
False papers so you could immigrate to Palestine as it was then?
Yes, I suppose so, but I didn't specify on it, of course.
So you chose not to go to Palestine?
No, if you went legally, then you had to go to Cyprus. And I felt nothing on earth would put me
behind bars again.
So, again, I was too young and I was too naive. There was a regiment called the Jewish Brigade. And I don't know, got to Palestine. She was blonde and blue-eyed, and no way did she look Jewish. But with the false papers, there were four of them all together. They went up to Budapest and they waited. And then they were sent, they started a journey. They were going to go through Romania and hopefully get a ship. And so
she went to Israel on these false papers.
And there were lists circulating. And eventually she found that I was alive. She called herself Shoshana because she thought I had also died in the camps.
She called herself Shoshana because she thought
yes.
It was Susan. And then she found out, and then what happened?
I thought of applying to go to Palestine. I was in Germany, and I wrote on the application form, on the way to visit my only living relative, Dr. and Mrs. Banyai. Of course, here was Germany, here was Scotland, and here was Palestine. So no way was it on the way. But nevertheless, my great uncle and great aunt also made an application. And meanwhile, I had met my husband-to-be.
He was in the Jewish Brigade, Paul.
Yes, he was in the Jewish Brigade.
So you had arranged to go to Palestine via air, and in between you met Howard's father, Paul.
My cousin, when she discovered that I was alive, and I had written to her, and what I had written was really true, meaning that we lost our parents and family and so on. Said, what on earth are you doing there? Why aren't you here with me? So I applied to go, but because of, I don't even know why or how, but because I mentioned Dr. and Mrs. Banyai in my application, and because they mentioned my name, in 1946, Paul and I went back to Kaunitz, where we were liberated. for Rosicena. And on the way out, we called at Badenhausen, which was where we put your application. And we asked what happened to my visa application. Oh, well, didn't you get your entry form? I said, no. Well, when you get back, you find it's crossed the letters.
So they checked the papers and they allowed you to come to Scotland?
You went back and found the application.
So you arrived and discovered you had a visa to take you to Scotland.
But you came to Scotland and then you decided to study as a teacher?
Not yet. First, I started nursing. I did 4 years nursing.
Because you had to choose between being a domestic or being a nurse. Is that correct?
Yes, yeah. You could either be somebody's maid, which I didn't fancy. Or be
How did you find nursing?
Well, I didn't do very much of it. And anyway, 3 months was the preliminary training school, but that winter was the worst, I don't know in how long. The practice in Stop Hill was that they stayed in the antenatal ward until their waters broke, and then
right.
A nurse took them to the maternity unit with the, you know, in an ambulance. This time it was so bad, the snow and so on, that half the staff didn't get in to hospital, and it was then, naturally, that two or three people need to go at the same time, their waters break. So there was nothing else for me but to go. They had to send me, and lo and behold, the ambulance got stuck. And I think if I didn't wet my pants, I came very near it, and the woman kept on saying, "In a fashion, in a fashion."
Yeah.
I had only been here in this country 3 months. I didn't know what she was saying. Well, eventually I asked her, and she said, "It means don't worry, dear." I took her there and I came back and they said, "What's the matter with you? Your face looks kind of green."
Did you decide after that year that you weren't cut out to be a nurse?
No. I had two small children. They were going to be in my care for a long time, so I wanted to have the same holidays.
That was later. You didn't have the children when you were nursing.
Pardon?
You didn't have the children when you were a nurse.
No.
You got married after that and then had the children.
Well, it was halfway through.
And later in Glasgow, am I right in saying that you were quite involved in politics?
In the Labour movement?
Yes, I'm afraid so.
I think that's great, actually.
How was it that you became involved in politics?
Through Annie Fireman. Did you know her?
Who was she?
She was a cousin of Mr. Cubis. She introduced me to the Carmichaels, Neil Carmichael. When I first got to know him, he wasn't an MP yet, but he became a Labour MP. He stood for Kelvin, and I lived in the West End then.
And you and Kay Carmichael became best friends.
Oh, yes,
yes.
That's right. Yes.
And
she died just very recently.
Was it difficult for a Jewish Hungarian refugee to be involved in Glasgow Labour politics?
Well, I don't know. Difficult to answer. There are so many things. After I wanted to go to university. Dr. Banyai, he wasn't, you know, it was my aunt who was the relative. He was, you know, said only about a few weeks after I arrived. I suppose you must have thought we were still as rich as we were in Vienna, so that we would put you through university. Well, that finished it for me.
A subtle way of telling you, I think.
So I went into Glasgow and I spoke to Annie Fireman, and she looked at the wording of my visa, and it said that I could take no jobs paid or unpaid except jobs of national importance, and they were of two kinds. One was to be a domestic maid, the other
nursing. That was when you went
nursing.
To nursing. That was before you were married.
Yes, I'm sure you must be tired now. So my last question for you, I haven't mentioned before or asked you anything about Judaism. Now, being Jewish caused you all that trouble in the past. Would you say it's still significant in your life after you came to Scotland, or did you just try and become an average Scottish Hungarian?
Well, I don't know. If I'd married a Hungarian, it would have been different, but, you know, I didn't, and very difficult to say. And, well, of course, there is the fact that although I'd been to Israel about 3 times, you know, I stayed here. I never went to
You didn't have much to do with Judaism at first, but then you met Dr. Cosgrove, didn't you?
Yeah, that's right.
What did he say?
I must have been very stupid. I don't know how I got through university. I said, they can choose when they are older. I'm not going to give you anything, any religion. And if you get nothing, if you don't get a choice, then you can't choose from nothing. So any fireman got me to go to, I think it was a Purim do, to Garnet Hill, and I got a tap on my shoulder, and you was a singer, and I said, yes. And at 9 o'clock Sunday morning.
Cider.
Those two children, yeah. That was Dr. Cosgrove.
After that, when Dr. Cosgrove commandeered them into Sunday school, I then got bar mitzvah at Garnet Hill. Of course, Garnet Hill wasn't the way it is now.
No. Very busy in our time, wasn't it?
Yes, I mean, the first year, I only got a seat at the window.
And now you could have a choice of seats. Thank you very much. That was very interesting. I know you taught for a number of years as well. Was that schools in the West End, or did you teach all over Glasgow?
You taught at the Girls' High.
I taught
French and German, then at Knightswood, and then you were head of department at Allan Glen's for many years before you retired.
15 years.
Tell Angela about what happened at your graduation.
I used my maiden name because, again, right or wrong, I didn't want to be any different from others. I wanted to be treated like everybody else.
You didn't want people making excuses for not doing essays if because you had the children. You didn't tell anyone your children, did you?
Isabel Ferguson.
Your best friend.
When I was doing Jordan Hill training, you had to be 5 weeks in the college and 5 weeks out. And I was sent to England, and this was our last year. There was this Jewish teacher at Heinlein, so she said, oh, the next class is through to the primary. And so we went along, and lo and behold, who comes down the stairs? Hi, ma'am. So she said nothing. Like the good Scotsman she is, anybody can make a mistake. The following week, again, we went to the same routine, and who comes along? Shirley.
Yes.
And then, hi, ma'am. So, by this time, the look on her face was, anybody can make one mistake, but two.
So you explained to her?
Yes. Yes, I had no choice.
At your graduation,
yes,
your
so
two
yes,
children appeared.
The rest of my class.
Nobody
my
knew
class.
It. So who are these? And you said, my children. Yeah.
And as if, you know, they had to be washed up.
That's right, yeah. That's right, yeah.